Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our second look at the Ypsilanti Ripper. Before we get into it, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe to the show, and leave a 5-star review. You can also become a Patreon member at tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content. Just as my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony, did, and my largest Patreon contributors monthly, Susan, Debbie, Mark, and Betty have done. Again, that's tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon. Link is in the description for the show. All right, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back, and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. We left off last week, having discussed the murder of Mary Therese Flesar on July 9th, 1967, and the subsequent investigation. Now, it would be almost an entire year before the killer who became known as the Michigan Murderer and the Ypsilanti Ripper would strike again. On July 1st of 1968, a 20-year-old art student at Eastern Michigan University by the name of Joan Elspeth Schell went missing. Joan's disappearance is unlike the other disappearances in this particular series of murders, in that there was a lot of deception going on almost immediately when she is reported missing in the morning hours of July 1st by her roommate. And we're gonna get into discussing all of this deception in a moment, but we're gonna lay out the bare facts first. At 1:47 a.m., Ypsi police received a phone call from Susan Colby, who lived on M Street in Ypsilanti. Now, Colby told the officer that answered the phone she was calling concerning her roommate, Joan Schell. Colby said that she was concerned because her roommate, Schell, had hitchhiked a ride to Ann Arbor that previous night of June 30th, but had not yet turned up at their mutual friend's house. Now, according to Colby, Schell had been going over to Ann Arbor to spend the night with a friend of theirs and had decided to take a bus. However, the two girls had walked to the bus stop only to discover that the last bus for the evening had already left. Obviously, the officer wants to know what time she last saw her friend, and Colby states about 2 hours ago. The officer is trying to put this young woman off, telling her, you know, she's probably running behind, but she shouldn't worry. Her roommate will probably arrive in Ann Arbor at any time now. Colby, however, interjects, letting them know that there were three men in a car who had pulled up. However, the officer doesn't want to hear this and tells Susan Colby that if she wants the police to look into this matter, she's going to have to wait a little bit longer to see whether or not Joan Schell actually makes it to Ann Arbor. At 7:38 a.m., Susan Colby again contacted the Ypsilanti Police Department, letting them know that Joan Schnell had not made any contact and that she had been in contact with their mutual friend in Ann Arbor, who stated that Joan had not yet arrived. At this point, the police decide to take Susan a little bit more seriously. They dispatch two officers to the apartment that Susan and Joan shared. According to the story that Susan initially told police, both she and Joan had left Ypsilanti that weekend and gone to their respective homes, with Joan heading to her home in Plymouth. Susan stated that she had returned early the previous evening, with Joan being dropped off by her parents at roughly 9:15 p.m. on Sunday night. Susan said that the two of them had hung out for a while before a phone call came in from this mutual friend in Ann Arbor, who, Susan stated, had called earlier in the evening looking for Joan. It was at this point that Joan decided that she was going to take a bus to Ann Arbor and spend the night. After checking with the bus company and learning that the last bus would leave at 10:30, Susan decided to accompany Joan to the bus stop, with Joan taking a large carryall filled with some personal effects along with her. Now, this bus stop was located near Eastern Michigan University's Welch Hall on Cross Street. The two girls arrived before 10:30, however, the bus never arrived. And according to Susan, at somewhere around 11:15, Joan decided that she was just going to hitchhike to Ann Arbor. Susan stated that she attempted numerous times to dissuade her friend from doing this, as she didn't think it was safe, but Joan was not to be deterred. Now, during all of this, the two girls had noticed a car, a red and black Pontiac Bonneville, driving by them a few times. At one point, the car had slowed before speeding off. Now, roughly 11:25, this same car, which was occupied by three males, drove past them again. However, this time, it pulled into a nearby cul-de-sac and stopped. Susan said that a pleasant enough-looking young white male, whose age she placed at about 20, got out of the passenger side car and called over to the two of them, asking if they wanted a ride. Susan puts his height at roughly 6 foot, with a slim build and clean cut dark hair, wearing a green t-shirt with the letters EMU across the front. She stated the man was wearing light-colored dungarees and white tennis shoes. Joan immediately responds, telling the young man that yes, she does need a ride, and despite Susan attempting to dissuade her from getting into the car with these three unknown men, Joan gets into the vehicle, letting Susan know that she will call her as soon as she arrives at their friend's house. Susan said the car then pulled from the cul-de-sac before driving off past McKinney Hall and turning right into a parking lot, at which point it disappeared from view. Susan said that she felt somewhat apprehensive over this and slightly depressed, and after standing at the spot where her friend had gotten into the car for a few moments, she slowly began to make her way back to their apartment. Susan said she went through all of her normal nightly routines, finishing up with reading a book as she waited for Joan to call. At somewhere around 12:30, their mutual friend in Ann Arbor contacted Susan to ask if Joan was still there, whether or not she was going to come for the evening. And Susan said that it was at this point that she began to feel that something seriously had gone wrong. She stated that she told this young woman on the other end of the line what had happened. This friend said that she would reach out to some of their mutual friends and that all of them would keep an eye out for the car which Joan had gotten into. According to Susan, both girls were hopeful that someone would spot this car with Joan in it or that Joan would make contact with one of them. And at roughly 1:45 a.m., this young woman in Ann Arbor had called back again to inform Susan that Joan still had not shown up, at which point Susan had decided to make contact with the police. Joan Schell was described as roughly 5'5", thin, with a weight of possibly 95 to 98 pounds, hazel eyes, and long, dark hair that came down almost to her waist. She was last seen wearing a blue miniskirt and tan-woven sandals, carrying a large red burlap handbag, inside of which were numerous personal effects, as well as a purple beaded purse that contained Joan's student ID. Susan informed officers that she believed that Joan had been wearing some jewelry when she left, a gold ring with a small pearl in its center, as well as a pair of circular gold earrings that were meant for women with pierced ears. The officers take all of this information down, as well as the names of Joan's parents, as well as their physical address and phone number, before leaving Susan and Joan's apartment. They also get the name and phone number of the friend that Joan was going to visit in Ann Arbor. The two officers would later state that after they left the apartment, they remembered Mary Flezer, who had disappeared and turned up dead the previous summer, and they realized that she only lived about 3 blocks from where Joan and Susan resided. A report is made up and it's turned over to the Ypsilanti Detectives Bureau. Well, back at the apartment, Susan is in somewhat of a panic, worrying about her friends. That afternoon, she contacts Joan's family and informs her that their daughter is missing. Reaching Joan's father at the department store where he worked, as she felt that if she called the house and reached Joan's mother, who had a heart condition, it might greatly upset the woman. Now, according to Joan's father, as he got this information concerning his daughter, the first thing he thought is that she had run off with her boyfriend, a 19-year-old who was currently stationed in the army. Now, Joan's family did not like this young man. They saw him as a troublemaker and a loser who had dropped out of high school. They knew he had been in trouble with the law on at least 2 occasions prior to enlisting in the army, and that he had gone AWOL from the service on a number of occasions, both of which concerned him coming back to Michigan from Georgia to spend time with Joan, whose father began to wonder whether or not his daughter had decided to travel down to Georgia to see her boyfriend. Inside the Ypsilanti Police Department, there was a lot of activity concerning Joan's case, as they still remembered Mary's murder from the previous summer. But there had also been a disturbing missing persons report made on June 23rd when an 18-year-old high school senior had not returned home, and it was learned that she was last seen in the company of three men driving a red and black car, which matched the description of the Pontiac Bonneville. Now, this car was quickly located outside a hotel where it was discovered that the three young men had taken turns having sex with the girl. Although, upon questioning, the girl refused to state that the men had taken advantage of or sexually assaulted her, asserting that everything that had occurred was consensual. So the officers, with this in mind, are thinking that a very similar situation may have taken place. So the officers very quickly make contact with these three men who were brought in, at which point Joan's roommate Susan arrives and is shown a lineup with these three men in it. However, she is unable to identify any of the men as having been either the driver, passenger, or man in the back seat of the car she had seen the previous night. Afterwards, Susan was brought outside to see the men's car, and she stated matter-of-factly that this was not the car she had seen her friend get into. Police were not done with the three young men, however. They questioned them quite extensively and learned that all of them had alibis for Sunday night. While all of that's going on, an officer sits down with Susan and begins going over the statement that she gave officers earlier that morning. When questions of Joan's boyfriend come up, officers noted that Susan's face became flushed as she tells them that Susan has not talked about him that much. Asked if she knows the young man's location, Susan states that she does not. At this point, Susan is released. Officers go over to the EMU campus to begin canvassing to see if anyone has seen anything, while one of the officers heads to Ann Arbor to question Joan and Susan's friend, whom she was supposedly going to spend the night with. Officers get to the point fairly quickly, demanding to know any information about Joan's boyfriend that this friend has, letting her know that they think he is very possibly involved with Joan's disappearance. The next day, the Plymouth Police Department receive a wire from Fort Gordon, Georgia, informing them that Joan's boyfriend has gone AWOL once again. According to Joan's father, that evening he received a phone call from Ypsilanti police wanting to know if they'd had contact with their daughter, but also wanting to know any information that they could provide concerning Joan's boyfriend, who was now a deserter from the U.S. Army. Obviously, Joan's father gives them everything that he knows, and as he would later tell reporters, hanging up the phone with the police, he had a sudden premonition that his daughter Joan was not, in fact, with her boyfriend. Up until this point, the local press had been persuaded to hold back anything concerning Joan Shell's disappearance. However, on July 3rd, the police gave them the go-ahead to start running news articles concerning her, which they did. This was in an attempt to bring forward any witnesses who may have seen something concerning Joan on the night of her disappearance. Instead of getting a flood of tips and eyewitnesses, however, Joan's family receives a phone call that evening from her boyfriend, who has seen the story in the local press and is concerned, insisting that he has not seen Joan at all. Jill's father attempts to find out where her boyfriend currently is, realizing that if he has seen the news clippings about his daughter, the young man must be local. However, he refuses and at this point hangs up. So Joan's father contacts the police and tells him of this phone call and that Jill's boyfriend insists she is not with him. Jill's father informs the detective that he wants to make a plea on one of the local television stations, Channel 4, out of Detroit, for any information concerning his daughter. The police agree that this is a wise move on his part. So the following Tuesday after Jill's disappearance, her father appears on the local broadcast, begging with anyone, be it his daughter, the person responsible for her disappearance, or even her boyfriend, to come forward to the police so that they can know what is going on with Joan. However, this does not produce any leads. What does come out of it, however, is a number of people come forward to corroborate the story that Susan had told the police concerning Joan's last known whereabouts. One of these was a maintenance worker from a motel in Ann Arbor. Man had been in Ypsanti spending the night with a friend and decided to catch the last bus back to Ann Arbor at around the same time that Joan and Susan were in the area. The man had gone and telephoned the bus depot after the final bus failed to arrive. However, no one picked up the phone, and he decided to walk back to the bus stop. The man told police that he had seen both young women standing next to a black and red Pontiac Bonneville, and that he had witnessed the one young woman who he identified as Joan Shell get into the back of the car, at which point the car had driven off. Man stated that after this, the other young woman had walked off and he had been forced to take a cab to Ann Arbor. The other person to come forward was a 16-year-old girl who had been sitting out on her front porch opposite of McKenney Hall. She told police she'd gone out onto the front porch around 11:30 that evening to get a breath of fresh air, and that as she stood there, she saw the two young women who, it appeared to her, were looking for a ride. She told the cops that she really didn't pay too much attention to them, as seeing young college co-eds was an extremely normal occurrence, although she did tell the police that one was taller than the other with blonde hair and glasses, the other was shorter with dark hair down to her waist and carrying a red bag. She said a few minutes later, her attention was drawn to the pair again when a red and black car pulled over and the two young women walked up to it. While she couldn't recall one of the occupants of the car getting out, she did remember seeing the shorter girl with the red bag getting inside of the car. Another individual, an EMU campus police officer, stated that he too saw the red car. However, when he saw it, it was pulling away from the curb and he was unable to see who was inside of it. More people started coming forward, two men that worked at McKenney Hall. One of them was a janitor who stated that at some point between 11 and midnight, he had come upon three young men inside of the building. Now, he did say to police it could have been earlier than his stated times. He really couldn't remember. But it was odd to find the young men inside of the building, as at this point in time, McKenney Hall was closed for the night. He said one of the young men was wearing a green EMU t-shirt and was talking on a payphone near the front entrance. This janitor informed the men that he walked up to them, informed them that he didn't know how they got into the building, but they needed to leave right away. At which point, he ushered them out of the building. Another janitor in the building informed the police that he had seen this interaction, but he had actually watched the men leave the building. At which point, they got into a red and black car, which sat idling for a few moments before driving away. However, in the police reports, it's noted that the individuals had to have been let into the building by someone or have had a key to the building, as after an examination, they could find nothing that indicated forced entry into McKinney Hall. It was also noted in the police reports that nothing had been reported stolen from the building, nor was there any form of vandalism presence. On July 5th, 1968, the Joan Shell case takes a tragic turn for the worse. A group of construction workers were working on Glacier Way in the northeastern part of Ann Arbor, excavating storm drains when one of them became aware of a rather putrid smell. Thinking that there was a dead animal nearby, two of the men went to investigate the source in the hopes that they could get rid of it, you know, throw it deeper into the woods so that the smell would not bother them. And instead, they came across the decomposing body of a young woman. At first glance, the younger woman was nude. It was apparent that her body had been assaulted, as it was covered with blood. There were numerous stab wounds on it. However, curiously enough, from the breast area upward, the body was completely black from decomposition, while from the beneath the breasts down, it appeared that the body was relatively intact. The men went and got their foreman, who was a former patrolman with the Ann Arbor Police Department. The man immediately went to investigate. He basically does his best to act as a police officer at this point, making certain that no one disturbs the crime scene while sending someone off to contact the local authorities, who race to the scene. When officers arrived at the scene, they found the body lying where it had been discovered. The underclothes and dress covered in mud had been wrapped tightly around the young woman's neck. While the body itself was lying on its right side with the arms splayed out around it, officers noted that there was one gold earring present in one of the decomposing ears. They also noted that the grass in the area immediately around the corpse had been trampled down, indicating that someone or someones had recently been in the area. After speaking with the construction workers, they quickly came to the conclusion that other than walking up to find the source of the smell, none of the men had gone close enough to the body to have caused the disturbance in the weeds. They also noted that there was no traces of blood around or beneath the body, despite the presence of a lot of it being dried on the corpse itself, which led them to conclude that the young woman had been killed elsewhere and then dumped at the scene. Officers concluded that the young woman had obviously been stored somewhere else, with the lower third portion of her body in a cool, damp place and the upper part of her body exposed to the elements, perhaps lying in a root cellar that had a window with her face and chest exposed to the sun. They also deduced that she had more likely than not been dumped at the spot on Glacier Road that morning at some point before 8 a.m. We'll be back in just a moment. You've heard me talk about it before, peeps and freaks. Chinese Mandarin is the number one in-demand language globally in the international job market. And I have a brand new sponsor this week just for you. Chinese teacher Mary. Mary goes deep into learning Mandarin, much the same way I go deep into covering true crime cases, ensuring that every single student not only understands pronunciation and sentence structure, but that they can differentiate between tones, read the language, and speak it fluently. I have never come across another Chinese teacher quite like Mary, because while she likes to have fun, and believe me, Mary is absolutely hilarious, she takes the job of teaching foreigners Chinese extremely seriously. So what I want you to do right now is go to tinyurl.com/ChineseTeacherMary, follow her, subscribe to her, come to her class, which is held 3 times a day. Support her and learn from her. Because I can almost guarantee you that after one lesson with Mary, you're going to realize that there is not a single teacher out there who is as dedicated to teaching as she is. Again, that's tinyurl.com/ChineseTeacherMary. Or just look for the link in the description. Hey there, D&Ders, your friend Ian here with another brand new sponsor this week. Artwork by Katie. Now, as the son of a fairly successful artist, I grew up around the art world, saw many different styles of art. I know good art from bad, and I can honestly say that in addition to being a good friend, Katie is one of the best artists I have ever had the pleasure of seeing. Her works of art, be it drawings or paintings, are absolutely amazing. And Katie doesn't just do original works of art, she also does commission pieces. So if you're looking for that perfect piece of art to offset the decor in your home, office, or even in your place of business, go check out Artwork by Katie at linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. That's linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. You'll be blown away. Body is removed to the nearby medical school at Michigan State University, and officers begin a thorough search of the scene. In Ypsanti, officers learn fairly quickly that a body has been discovered in Ann Arbor, and according to one account, almost immediately after finding out this information, they receive a phone call from Joan's boyfriend, who is still AWOL from the military. This young man eventually concedes to being questioned by police, who pick him up at 4:35 p.m. on that day, July 5th, from Joan and Susan's friend's apartment. He's taken to the county jail in Ann Arbor, where it's decided that he will be turned over to the military authorities only after a thorough questioning. This young man, upon being read his rights, tells the officers that he is there because he's gone AWOL from the Army. Officers then inform him that he is also being held on possession of a concealed weapon. When this young man had been picked up by the police, he had given the address for the boarding house that he was staying at. Officers had obtained a search warrant, and inside of this room he was staying in, they found a pair of brass knuckles. The officers then turned the course of the conversation to discussing Joan Schell. The young man insists emphatically that he did not know where his girlfriend was, becoming visibly upset and even breaking down and weeping as the course of the interview continues. They learn that he had arrived back in the area early Sunday morning and had not been able to make contact with Joan until that Sunday night. They learned that it was not the friend of Joan and Susan who had made contact and asked Joan to come to Ann Arbor, but was in fact her boyfriend, and that everything involving this friend of theirs was in fact a cover story should Joan's parents learn that he is in the area or decide to reach out to their daughter. According to this young man, both Susan and this other unnamed friend were aware he was in the area, but had done their best to help him conceal his presence, as they didn't want him to get picked up by the police, although he insisted that upon learning that Joan was missing, all three of them became gravely concerned. Officers very quickly are able to ascertain that Joan's boyfriend has nothing to do with her disappearance, and that another person who is unknown to them at this point in time is in fact responsible for both Joan's disappearance and her murder. This was confirmed when it was learned that the boyfriend and the friend had borrowed a friend's car and spent more than an hour driving back and forth between Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti looking for her or the red and black car. The autopsy was done on the body that afternoon. The victim was listed as being 5 feet 5 inches tall and weighing under 100 pounds. Although a precise weight could not be determined due to advanced decomposition, the victim had been stabbed 50 times, 25 times in the torso, 22 times in the back, and twice in the side. The weapon was believed to be a knife that was under 4 inches in length. The damage done by the stabbing included punctures to the right lung and liver, the severing of the carotid artery on the left side of the neck, a fracture in the skull from where the knife had been thrust into the head from behind. It was later determined that the victim had been sexually assaulted as traces of male seminal fluid were found inside of the vagina, as well as tearing of the vaginal muscles. However, it was not able to be determined whether the victim had been sexually assaulted prior to or after death, or both. As for articles found on the body, as described, there was one gold earring found hanging from the ear. There was also an imitation gold ring with a pearl in it on her right hand. The pathologist estimated that the victim had been dead for anywhere from 5 to 6 days. Obviously, the victim is going to be identified as Joan Schell. On Monday, July 8th, a meeting was held by multiple police precincts inside of Washtenaw County. And at this meeting, it was decided that because the murder of Mary Therese Flezar and Joan Schell bore such striking similarities, not only in the brutality shown to the victims' bodies, but also in the manner of disappearance, they were more likely than not connected. Officers leave this meeting and immediately begin to try and track down the exact make and model of this car, as anyone locally who has access to such a car. But they also were able to put together a composite sketch of the man who had invited Joan to get into the vehicle. This came from Susan. This composite is going to end up being circulated around the area. Officers also undertake the arduous task of trying to determine where Joan's body may have been stored during the period that she was deceased, that would lead her to being partially decomposed, although not fully so. Going to storm cellars, root cellars, basements, although nothing ends up being discovered. When Joan Schell is buried, there is a considerable undercover police presence, as it's thought that if this crime is the same as the individual who took the life of Mary, then a similar situation as occurred at the funeral home where Mary lay in repose may occur. If you'll recall, the day of the funeral, a man had shown up claiming to be from the family, wanting to take pictures of Mary's body, which was held inside of a sealed coffin due to the extreme amount of decomposition that had taken place. And when informed, not once but twice, that no photographs would be allowed, the man had run from the funeral home. Coming out of all of this, a number of organizations begin offering rewards for information leading to the capture of the individual responsible for Joan Schell's abduction, rape, and murder. Eventually, it is going to top out at $7,800. However, even with the rewards being offered, no pertinent information comes in concerning Joan's disappearance and murder. In mid-August, however, police receive information that two students have been telling others that they had seen Joan on the night of her disappearance in the presence of another student, a male, whom both of them knew intimately. They learned that both of these students worked at the EMU cafeteria, and so, assisted by a member of the campus police, a detective from the Ann Arbor Police Department went and interviewed them. Both individuals, a man and a female, were interviewed separately, with one, a 20-year-old male, protesting vehemently that he did not want to get anyone in trouble. The initial statement that the man gave was that on Sunday night, he and the other EMU cafeteria worker whom he was dating were with another friend of theirs driving around the campus when they had seen a woman whom he identified as Joan walking with a male. At first, this man refused to identify the individual who Joan was with, only saying that he was a member of the same fraternity as he was. Police pressed him on this issue, however, trying to get the identity of this individual. At first, he states that he can't even really be sure as to whether or not the person he had seen was Joan, despite the fact that both he and his girlfriend worked with her at the cafeteria. He also says he can't even be sure that this individual who was pledged to the same fraternity as him and had pledged at the exact same time was the man he had seen in Joan's presence. Although, eventually he does give up the name of the man as being John Collins. Now, the man then states that he didn't really think that it was John Collins, as he had seen Collins a few days later and mentioned seeing him in the presence of this girl who had disappeared. And Collins had assured him that it couldn't have been him, as A, he did not know Joan, but also he was not even in the area at that time. He was spending the weekend with his mother in Detroit. Police then moved their questioning to where they had seen Joan and this John Collins individual, at which point they learned that it was over on Emmett Street, right where it crosses College Place, which coincidentally is right by where Joan and Susan had lived. The man then tells the officers that he believes the time he saw the couple was around 9:30. However, they're later going to learn that his timeline of events is incorrect. For the record, Joan and Susan were both in their apartment at 9:30 that evening. After this, the officers speak with the man's girlfriend, from whom they learn that both she and her boyfriend, as well as this other unnamed individual, had been at her apartment drinking beer that evening when they realized that it was time to go and pick up her roommate, who worked as a waitress at a nearby restaurant. So the three of them left the apartment to go get this roommate. She stated that they saw Joan and this other individual, this John Collins, at this point at the intersection of Emmett and Collins Place. And while she said that she could positively identify Joan as the woman she saw, she could not definitively put John Collins as the man who was in his presence. After getting their roommate, the four of them went to the fraternity house, where they continued to drink and watched a movie on television. When asked for a time that all of this took place, the young woman stated that it had to have been somewhere between 11:15 or 11:30. Obviously, the police are very interested in this John Collins individual, who also goes by the name of John Chapman. So they seek him out and learn that he lives directly across the street from Susan and Joan. He is majoring in juvenile education. He is 21 years of age, from Detroit, Michigan. He works part-time at the McKinney Union, which is in McKinney Hall. He tells police that he does not know Joan, either from the school or from the Emmett Street neighborhood, and that he has lived in the room on Emmett Street by himself since the springtime. When asked as to his whereabouts on the night of June 30th, Collins tells police that he was at his mother's home in Centerline, which is part of Detroit, and that he had not returned to Ypsilanti until after midnight on Monday. He also informs police that they can check with a man who lives across the hall from him, who's actually his roommate, to verify his movements as well as the time that he returned to the house. When asked about the kind of car he drove, Collins states that he drives an old DeSoto, but that he also drives a fairly newer motorcycle. He tells the detectives that he cannot recall anyone that he knows who drives a red and black car of any type. When asked if he knew the individual who had brought him to the police's attention, Collins state that he does, in fact, know this man, although it could not possibly have been he, Collins, that this man had seen on that night, as he was not in the area. Police put in their notes that he was very engaging, although they felt that he was working at trying to appear unabashed. Now, the police do a cursory examination of the story that Collins gives, and it appears, for all intents and purposes, that his alibi is airtight. Further, they check with a few police officers that Collins is familiar with, who he says can vouch for him as character witnesses, and learn that both of these individuals hold Collins in high regard. And it's at this point that the police turn their attention away from John Norman Collins and seek to pursue new leads, if any, that are going to come in the case of Joan Schell. But as with the murder of Mary Flesar, Joan Schell's murder soon grows cold, and detectives are left with few avenues of inquiry to pursue. We're going to end this week's episode at this point. I hope that you guys have enjoyed this second look at the Ypsilanti Ripper. Until next time, stay morbid!